From World Radio and the creative team that brings you the world and everything in it, this is Effective Compassion.
Members of the Congress, I have the high privilege and distinct honor of presenting to you and wishing to him a happy birthday, the President of the United States.
February 6th, 1985. Ronald Reagan had been sworn in for a second term just 2 weeks before. At 9 p.m., he addressed the crowd gathered in the legislative chamber.
I come before you to report on the state of our union.
Part of Reagan's speech focused on the role of volunteers in communities and how they contributed to American society. And at the end of his 40-minute address, he highlighted one woman's work.
Now, there's someone else here tonight, born 79 years ago. She lives in the inner city where she cares for infants born of mothers who are heroin addicts.
Her name was Clara Hale, but people called her Mother Hale. One senator described her as magical or having a saint-like quality. In 1969, she started a home for infants born already addicted to drugs.
She helps them with love. Go to her house some night and maybe you'll see her silhouette against the window as she walks the floor, talking softly, soothing a child in her arms. Mother Hale of Harlem, and she too is an American hero.
Hale House became a haven for abandoned children. In 1985, NBC's Bob Dodson featured Clara Hale in The American Story.
Hello, precious. Hello, angel.
Hundreds of such children have been saved by Clara Hale, a woman who faces life with antique courage.
All of them don't have to die because some of them have the determination to live. I'm just glad that I'm able to do something for them.
Brush your teeth and comb your hair.
For decades, Hale's name was legendary. Then it became infamous. I'm Anna Johansson Brown.
I'm Sarah Schweinsberg.
And this is Effective Compassion.
Effective Compassion is made possible by listeners like you. Additional support comes from Samaritan Ministries, a biblical solution to healthcare, connecting you to other Christians who will care for you spiritually and financially when you experience a medical need. More at SamaritanMinistries.org/worldpodcast.
This episode is about nonprofits that take a wrong turn and the lessons we can learn about accountability, transparency, and the value of help that has an expiration date. Hale House won applause from politicians and celebrities alike. In the 1990s, singer Karen White came to visit the kids there.
You love me, we're a happy family.
Being a mother has really makes me love more, care more, and just feel like, every child is beautiful and I want to help in any way I can. These children here are so precious, so innocent, and they've started off. They've had a rough start.
In the 60s and 70s, people didn't realize just how many consequences there were for the unborn children of drug addicts. It wasn't mainstream information that kids would be born with physical and psychological consequences because of their parents' behavior. So Hale House was a bit countercultural. Clara Hale cared for the infants as they went through withdrawal and the fevers, trembling, and vomiting that came along with it. She hired psychologists, chiropractors, and therapists to help the children as they grew up.
Over the next 20 years, Clara Hale cared for more than 800 children. She died in 1992 at the age of 87. That's when her daughter, Lorraine, took over Hale House.
Lorraine Hale and her husband, Jesse DeVore, operated Hale House for 10 years. And almost at once, people started to complain.
In 2001, reports began to circulate that Hale House was neglecting children. It wasn't licensed to house that many kids, and it didn't have enough staff to take care of them. Some mothers said they hadn't been able to visit their kids for months on end. Then investigators started looking into the organization's financials.
Jesse DeVore had written a letter to donors asking for funds. He said if the organization didn't get more cash, the children would be without food and diapers. But at the same time he wrote that letter, Hale House had $10 million in an investment account. Employees reported that at one point, they overheard DeVore calling the children cash cows.
Lorraine Hale began diverting checks marked to care for the children into a personal bank account. She invented fake board members and used them to authorize fake expenses. She used thousands of dollars to bankroll DeVore's failing theater company and install a jacuzzi at their home.
All told, Hale and DeVore embezzled more than $1.7 million. In 2001, prosecutors indicted the two on 72 counts of fraud and booted them from the organization. They pleaded guilty and promised to pay back hundreds of thousands of dollars to the charity in return for no jail time.
Lorraine Hale died in 2013 at age 86. Hale House limped along under a new name for a few years. It eventually faded into an educational center run by a different nonprofit. So what went wrong?
The character of the leader does affect the organization.
This is Brian Fickert, founder of the Chalmers Center and author of When Helping Hurts. We talked to him a couple of episodes ago. As the leader of a nonprofit, he has a front row seat to the traps that can so easily trip up those who head ministries and nonprofits. And on one level, he says, we shouldn't be surprised.
And so that when it says in Genesis chapter 3 that the fall happened, that we would embrace that that really did happen, and that the fall has impacted every square inch of the cosmos, including our individual hearts.
That means leaders, too.
Numbers 6 and 11, God says, circle the city. And when they marched around the seventh time on the seventh day, God said, shout!
Kirby John Caldwell pastored a megachurch in Houston, Windsor Village United Methodist Church. It was the denomination's largest church with more than 18,000 members. Caldwell was a spiritual advisor to Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. He spoke at prayer meetings and prayed at inaugurations.
I greet you in the name of our Lord and deliverer Jesus the Christ, and welcome to the prayer service. We have gathered here today at the urging and leadership of our President-elect, the Honorable George W. Bush.
But in 2018, he was accused of selling fake Chinese bonds to investors, $3.5 million worth. The bonds were real, but they were antiques, not recognized by China's current government, and so not worth the fortune Caldwell promised.
For years, Caldwell maintained his innocence.
But again, the bonds are absolutely legitimate. I have proof of that.
And from the pulpit, church members believed him wholeheartedly.
He is a man of integrity. He is a man of integrity. And we believe that the truth will come out.
I don't believe those allegations are true. I know Kirby John Caldwell. He's an honest, ethical man.
But in March 2020, as the evidence piled up, Caldwell pleaded guilty to wire fraud and defrauding investors. He was sentenced to 6 years in prison.
So what do we do when trusted leaders fall? More importantly, how can we avoid being taken in by nonprofits or leaders that might not be so trustworthy? Brian Fickert says we first need the right expectations.
So often we set up our leaders on a pedestal. We treat them like they are uniquely sanctified or something, that sin doesn't happen to them. And that puts them into sort of a quandary because they can't admit weakness. They can't say, I'm struggling with X, Y, or Z, because they're expected to kind of put on this facade of it's all okay.
Ministries need to give leaders the freedom to admit fault.
We've got to create that kind of environment, first of all. And then secondly, look for signs. Is this person resting? Most leaders struggle with being a workaholic. So I have some staff right now who are looking at me and saying, Brian, you know what? Are you resting properly? We see that you're under a lot of stress. Are you exercising? Are you spending time in the Word? Are you going for a walk? And so I've got people around me watching me. And that's what our leaders need, are people watching them. And then accountability partners. Who is getting in your face and asking you what's going on?
Leaders need board members and accountability partners who don't just do whatever the leader says. They need to be independent and confident enough to challenge strong, charismatic leaders. Because without that, leaders slip.
There are a lot of temptations and pitfalls when you're in charge of an organization. A lot of ways to fudge things, especially when it comes to finances. For example, you've probably heard the 100% promise before. That's when a nonprofit says that 100% of all donations go straight to helping people. So if you give them money, it won't be used for administrative costs or fundraising campaigns or executive salaries.
Smile Train was one of the first nonprofits to popularize that phrase. It started in 1999.
Using the Teach a Man to Fish model, we empower local doctors to perform cleft lip and palate repair surgery in their communities.
The nonprofit has performed more than 1 million surgeries for people all over the world. Doctors repair cleft lips and palates, helping children eat, speak, and breathe more easily. Smile Train is still wildly popular, and it actually gets top ratings from multiple charity trackers. So it is doing a lot of things right, but it still ran into trouble.
Right from the get-go, Smile Train promised that 100% of donations would go to help people. None of those funds would be used for administrative costs. But in its early years, Smile Train spent 34% of its cash budget on overhead costs. How is that possible? Well, let's talk financials.
Nonprofits get donations all the time. Some have no strings attached. Here's a check. You can use it for whatever purpose you choose. Those are unrestricted funds. Other donations have stipulations. The person giving the money wants it used for a specific purpose, a specific part of the ministry. Those are restricted funds, and they can't be used for just anything.
In 2005, Smile Train performed a fiscal audit. The numbers showed that 99% of its funds were unrestricted, so the people who gave that money hadn't set a specific purpose for it. And according to Smile Train's philosophy of 100% of donations go directly to helping people, all of that money should have gone to doctors and kids. None of it should have been used for overhead costs.
But in 2006, Smile Train did some money juggling. It shifted $51 million into a temporarily restricted fund and said that money had been earmarked to cover overhead costs all along. It insisted the donors who gave those funds wanted them used for administration and salary and fundraising, and Smile Train just hadn't classified the money correctly.
But there's no written record of those donors saying that. In fact, one of the donors has the money listed as going to Smile Train's general program, not overhead costs. Smile Train's co-founder, Brian Mullaney, later left the organization after a flurry of controversy and accusations of financial mismanagement.
At this point, you might be thinking, okay, so people who have lots of money are prone to fraud. But Brian Fickert says it's not just the well-off.
I do think that the magnitude of the ministry can add to the problem. But my word, we're all prone to sin. I don't need big things to happen for me to be prone to sin. I'm pretty good at sinning even in small situations.
You know what they say about the love of money.
Many high-profile leaders of massive organizations have fallen because of that temptation. It's a pitfall that snares leaders at all levels and people of all kinds.
But there's another major theme that crops up in cautionary tales like these. Many organizations fall because of sexual indiscretion. In 2018, the anti-poverty charity Oxfam came under fire for just that. The group had sent aid workers to Haiti after the 2010 earthquake that devastated the island.
It took years for the reports to surface. 9 Oxfam staff members had been soliciting earthquake survivors for sexual acts. Haiti banned the entire organization from operating in the country. Celebrities who once endorsed Oxfam pulled their support. The UK threatened to pull $50 million in funding. Oxfam had to lay off staff to cope with the drop in donor support. And organization officials apologized left and right.
From the bottom of my heart, forgive us, forgive Oxfam. And I'm really inviting anyone who has been a victim of abuse by anyone in our organization to come forward. I want them to come forward and for justice to be done for them.
I'm deeply ashamed about Oxfam's behavior. Then everybody, the 25,000 staff and volunteers, are compromised by this. And to everybody, I do apologize.
The Oxfam scandal centered on just a small handful of people. That's true of many cases like this, where the whole organization gets pulled down because of the failings of a few. And sometimes we might wonder, aren't these just examples of personal, individual failings?
That's part of the story, but it's not the whole story. In Oxfam's case, reports began to surface that the nonprofit knew about the abuse, but at best, failed to report it properly. and at worst, intentionally covered it up.
Brian Fickert says cases like these are an indication of systemic failure, a flawed organizational structure and culture that enabled those actions.
And the problem is that many organizations don't have proper accountability measures in place. Oftentimes, our organizations tend to separate our work lives from our personal lives, when in fact, in reality, they're all connected, right? And what's happening in our families spills over into our work.
He says board members need to get in the leaders' faces, ask questions, and look at the whole picture.
What's happening in your marriage? What's happening in your family? What's happening in your spiritual life? How can we support you? Boards don't do a great job at that, but it's absolutely essential for the leader to thrive and then for the whole organization to thrive.
Remember back in episode one? We talked about organizational structure, how the systems you put in place and the vision you set affect the entire nonprofit. Ministries need good structure and accountability to avoid personal failings. And they also need good vision and practical action steps.
That affects a nonprofit's daily operations. An organization may be healthy, transparent, and accountable, but it also needs to put its resources in the right place. Some organizations see a legitimate need and want to help with that, but sometimes they don't pick the best strategy to get there.
Finally, tonight, our person of the week. He's built a multi-million dollar business by getting people to buy his shoes, and now he's trying to change the world by giving them away and getting celebrities like J-Lo to go barefoot.
That's audio from an ABC report in 2011 talking about Toms. If you've ever paid attention to shoes before, you've probably seen a pair of these. Everybody loves Toms, the simple canvas slip-on shoes that come in every color and pattern known to man.
Contrary to what you might expect, they were not invented by a guy named Tom. Nope, his name is Blake Mycoskie. He used to be on the reality TV show The Amazing Race. On a polo trip to Argentina, he saw dozens of kids without shoes. If their feet got cut or scraped, they could easily get infected, or they could get parasites like hookworms.
I wanted to help these kids get shoes, and I didn't want to make it hard to keep track of, so I said, we'll sell a pair, so then we can give a pair.
He called it Shoes for Tomorrow, hence Toms.
When you're putting that shoe on a child's foot, it's a really intimate, personal experience that you're sharing with that child. You know, seeing the joy on these kids' faces really touched me.
Mycoskie designated April 8th as one day without shoes. Celebrities like Jennifer Lopez, the Jonas Brothers, and Kristen Bell jumped on board.
I'm going barefoot for one day without shoes to raise awareness about the impact a simple pair of shoes can have on a child's life.
People like the idea that they can buy something for themselves to benefit other people. It's compelling. But the shoe drop model has a number of drawbacks.
First, it's a handout model, and handouts tend to create dependencies. If someone is receiving material goods without any strings attached, they may come to expect those donations and build an unhealthy reliance on them.
Second, it doesn't get to the main question of why these children don't have shoes in the first place. It's fixing a symptom, but not the root cause. Here's a business owner in Uganda, Teddy Rouge, talking about Toms in Africa.
The shoes is the least of our problems, really, guys. We're worried about malaria. We're worried about getting jobs. We're just worried about having electricity in the village, for example. Well, what it does is actually put people who are creating shoes right out of business.
One study published on the Social Science Research Network showed that used clothing donations had a negative impact on the clothing industry in Africa. Over a 20-year period, the donations were responsible for a 50% drop in employment in that industry. Giving things away is sometimes necessary, but it shouldn't be a default strategy.
And the buy one, give one model isn't a bad idea. It just needs a few safeguards. Brian Fickert actually likes the concept.
And so I don't have so much a problem with that sort of buy one, get one thing. I think the issue is, what are you getting? What is the thing that you're releasing out into the field? Are you releasing just some material resource that's going to be hurled out there? Or you are actually releasing something that's going to be empowering, relational? And so, for example, what if you bought a pair of shoes and that released money to pay for highly relational staff who are walking hand in hand with low-income people? I'd be all in on that.
After a couple of years in operation, Tom's started to run into some problems with its iconic shoes. First, they were easy to duplicate. Other companies created knockoffs, like the Skechers brand, Bob's. Skechers donated two pairs of shoes for each one sold. People started to wonder if Tom's shoes were worth the $50 to $80 price tag. or if the donated shoes were having a real impact. So Tom's hired some researchers to do an impact evaluation study.
The researchers focused on 1,500 children in rural El Salvador. They wanted to test the impact of Tom's shoes on the economy, on school attendance, health, and aid dependency. In other words, did the shoe donations hurt local shoe sellers? Did they help the kids stay healthy and walk to school more consistently? And did they increase the kids' dependence on outside aid?
When the researchers studied the impact of shoe donations on local shoe vendors, they concluded that there was a negative impact on local shoe sales. But overall, it was actually pretty small. Local shoe vendors sold one fewer pair of shoes for every 20 pairs that were donated.
When the researchers studied the impact of Tom's shoes on the kids, they found that all the children loved the shoes and wore them a lot. And there was at least a little evidence that they spent more time outside after getting the shoes, instead of watching TV.
But overall, there was no impact on the children's physical well-being. The shoes didn't benefit their overall health or their foot health like Tom's had hoped. And another not-so-great result, the kids who did receive the shoes were significantly more likely to state that outsiders should provide for the needs of my family, instead of answering, my family should provide for its own needs.
In response to the study, Tom's did decide to make some changes. To try to cut down on dependency, the company began giving shoes to kids as rewards for school attendance and performance. And over the years, Tom's has actually moved away from the buy one, give one model. In 2019, it announced a new system. For every $3 the company makes, it gives $1 away. It might be less concrete, but it gives it flexibility to support a whole host of causes the company wants to get behind, like distributing clean water and eyeglasses, and decreasing bullying and gun violence.
At the end of the day, there's no silver bullet, no surefire way to fix this problem or that problem. Organizations are free to experiment, create new strategies, try new things. But it's always important to keep an eye on their accountability, both for the organization's staff and financials.
And there are a few core principles that generally lead to effective strategies, strategies that break cycles of poverty and need. Donors or volunteers or outside observers should keep those principles in mind when getting involved with the ministry. Here's how Brian Fickert puts it.
Are they discovering the assets and the gifts of people who are materially poor, or are they simply dumping material resources into low-income villages around the world? You can start to look at, are they including the poor as full participants in their own improvement, or are they simply imposing strategies from the outside? There's principles that can form the lenses through which you start to examine ministries and start to say, do I see this happening here?
Next time on Effective Compassion, we'll visit a few ministries working with the homeless, but using very different philosophies.
The ultimate goal is to move them from shelter into permanent housing as quickly as possible.
That's next time on Effective Compassion. I'm Sarah Schweinsberg.
And I'm Anna Johansson Brown. Effective Compassion is produced by the creative team at World Radio. Our producer is Lee Jones, our audio editor is Paul Butler, and our podcast engineer is Rich Rosel.
Additional support for Effective Compassion comes from Samaritan Ministries, a community of Christians who, through prayer, encouragement, and financial support, will care for you when you have a medical need. When the body of Christ comes together to provide for one another, burdens are lifted and God is glorified. This applies to all areas of life, including healthcare. More at SamaritanMinistries.org/worldpodcast.